Well, let me buzz through this overview more a little brisker pace so that we can actually get into the meat of things. I've got a graph here that shows you just how much performance increase you get with each version. But these are essentially the versions that you have now. Pro Tools 10, the basic version that you get, is 96 mono or stereo tracks. You can upgrade that to 256 tracks by buying the production toolkit, complete production toolkit. And it's the same number of tracks, whether it's CPTK, HD Native, or HDX. And this is where you start to see the performance of the system start to surpass the capabilities of HD TDM, is when you start to compare Pro Tools 10 and beyond. And again, the biggest number is this one at the bottom here. At the basic lowest end of Pro Tools, you still get 16,000 samples of delay compensation, whereas with HD TDM, you're still stuck with 4,095. So, huge performance bump there. We talked about clip gain. We talked about disk cache. What else did we talk about? Plugins. AAX is the new plugin format, which is will operate. Not that anyone here has an opinion about that, but AAX is supposedly their cross-platform plugin format now that will operate on both their HDX systems and natively, if there's such a word. A lot of the plugin manufacturers are starting to port for AAX so that you can use their plugins going forward, but some have not yet made the big move. That's a rumor. I'm not sure exactly that that's true. We're going to have to wait until we see Pro Tools 11 before we know for sure. So hang on that one and stand by. We'll see. We talked about Audio Suite. We talked about working with Media Composer. Trying to hit right on the high points here. Oh, yeah, if you buy a complete production toolkit, you get the same tool set as HD operators. So I don't know what the price tag is for CPTK, do you?
It's expensive.
It's like $1,800 last time I looked or something like that.
$1,500 to get to it.
Yeah. Right, but if you buy the basic version of Pro Tools and then get CPTK, you've essentially got the same.
But if you buy hardware, you get Pro Tools software for free. And if you get a little native system, you get that feature for free. So.
Right.
I mean, they're obviously pushing you to buy their hardware.
Right. Clearly. So see a Pro Tools dealer near you to find all of the latest, greatest deals. There's a list of 50 new features, some of which are really not all that exciting. So we're just going to move on.
RAM.
Yeah, RAM. If you've got a machine with 8 gigabytes in it, if you've got a laptop with 8 gigs in it, you should be able to run just about any Pro Tools session on it. Where you start to run out of RAM is if you have a giant session and it's trying to cache all of the audio internally. We talked about that before. It will have to store some of that information or read and write in real time off of a hard drive. One of the drawbacks to a 32-bit system is running lots of virtual instruments. Anyone composing in Pro Tools? Nobody? Okay. Lots of folks use other platforms just because of the 64-bit capabilities, better RAM utilization. But if you're trying to run a lot of virtual instruments, you'll find that 8 gigabytes of RAM goes by pretty quickly. But not just that. Pro Tools is only designed to recognize 2 gigabytes of RAM max for virtual instruments. So no matter how much RAM you stick in your computer, whether it's a tower with 64 gigs or whatever you have, it will not use more than 2 gigabytes of RAM to load virtual plugins or virtual instruments. So you're going to run out of space really quickly. With a 64-bit Pro Tools, which we hope we'll see in 11, you have as much capability as any of the other, Logic or Cubase or any of the other native systems to run virtual instrument plugins. So that's a huge step forward for composers. And then, of course, the HDX system is their hardware DSP, high-speed processing. And this is where somebody asked the question, how much processing power does it really have? There's five times the DSP on an HDX card that there was on an XL card. and 32-bit floating point math, increased mixer headroom with 64-bit floating point math, which basically means you can shove more things into your mix bus before it clips. This is the one graph that I found really interesting, the latency stats. For HDX, 0.7 milliseconds latency using that hardware, which, what's the speed of sound these days?
186,000
miles per second. How many feet?
100 feet per second.
Right. So how many feet per millisecond?
Roughly one.
Right. So the latency in an HDX system is less than a foot. Being farther, a foot farther from a microphone. So I'd say that's pretty doggone good. My HD rig is 0.96 milliseconds, so I'm still pretty darn good. Brian, behave yourself.
That's a foot and a half.
HD, yeah. Well, HD native is a foot and a half, 1.7 milliseconds. And then you get into the external hardware, the MBOX stuff, and then you start to get all the way up to 10 milliseconds of latency, which is still pretty stinking good if you ask me. But that's where we got into that discussion earlier about if you're going to do live overdubs, you want to get into one of the HD systems. What else? Oh, that's none. You're not supposed to see that. Don't pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Yeah. You know, I wanted to talk a little bit about, we talked about recording exciting new things in Pro Tools 10. How many of you are working in post-production currently, and that includes game sound? Okay, and most of you folks are doing music though, right? Okay, so for mixing, I don't know how far you guys have gotten into really punishing a Pro Tools system in a mix, but with my current laptop, 80 tracks, yeah. I've had mixes that big on my laptop. I couldn't run a 24-bit 96 or higher session on a laptop and get that kind of performance. But where you start to find limitations on a smaller system are if you're running video content along with your audio, then all of a sudden the system slows down, and typically they suggest that you run your video off of a separate hard drive if you're going to be doing any post-production work. The reason I talk about that is it's the chosen platform for people doing movies and trailers and TV shows. Folks are working primarily in Pro Tools, and so you have to get a bigger system if you want to run video and do composition or do a complex sound design movie mix. But there are movie mix houses now that use multiple seat Pro Tools systems. They'll get a giant Pro Control, or a Pro Control, how old am I? D Control. And they'll run multiple Pro Tools systems linked together to mix a movie. So a lot of the movies that you see in the theater nowadays are mixed on pretty big HDX systems on D Control systems. Editing and mixing. Let's see. I recorded these tracks with my UW class, like I said, a week ago. And, you know, they sound pretty darn good just the way they were. But I wanted to show you a couple of tricks that I do with drum kits that... This isn't necessarily a Pro Tools 10 thing exclusively, but rather just nifty ways to use and abuse your Pro Tools rig. Let's say how many of you guys use Sound Replacer? Bunch of folks, okay. Sound Replacer will allow you to identify transient peaks in a track and replace those transients with other transients. So obviously the fastest thing that I can come up with to use would be a drum track. Right? What other ways can you replace sounds in a drum track?
Overdub,
sure.
Overdub?
Yes, right. There's a bunch of other additional plugins that you can use to audition other drum samples. But
Drumagog
can use it. You do it in real time, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sound Replacer does it. And works real good in 10.
Does it?
Oh, does it? I haven't
Better
used it.
Than ever. Yeah. I gave up on it until I tried 10 and it came to life.
Really? Yeah. I haven't used Drum-A-Gog in 10. There's like three or four programs out there that do the same or similar thing. BFD. I'm not sure if the Steven Slate plugin has that capability, but I showed my class a really quick way to do drum replacement using strip silence to divide up the kick drum track into its component hits and strip it out, and then pick a sample of a kick drum that I liked, and simply just by advancing from transient to transient, you can copy and paste. We did this with an Adele mix. I had the audio for a live Adele performance. And if you remember, the Rolling in the Deep started out with that giant kick drum sound. Live, they didn't do that. They just had the drummer hitting the kick drum. And so we wanted to make it our mix sound like the original Adele mix. So we copied off of the original record. We copied one of the kick drum hits and then used Sound Replacer, and we used this method to replace all the kick drums to give it that giant sound. I hope Adele doesn't find out. We improved on her mix. It was pretty fun. There's a way to handle drums. You guys record a lot of drums? Yeah? Okay. You use room mics? Yeah? What size rooms are you typically recording drums in?
This room.
In this room? Okay, where do you put room mics? Where do you put the drums and where do you put the room mics?
It varies depending on the experiment. Sometimes in the cubby hall, sometimes up against the curtain where the chimes are, sometimes against the blackboard, sometimes in a booth, although it's a little cramped.
But then you have room mics out here around the space?
Yeah.
Well, we had, in this particular space we were working in, we didn't have the volume of a room like this. We didn't have quite that much space. But what we did, we were able to get a room mic about 12 feet away, roughly, from the drum kit. And I'm going to play a little bit of the drum track without the room mics. Rick, I don't know how loud this is going to be, but you might want to... So this was a Led Zeppelin tune that the drummer was playing along with. We actually have right? Hitting on the moonshine, rocking in the grain. So the drum sounded pretty cool with the close mics, but we wanted something bigger than that. We wanted to get John Bonham. So we took the room track, which sounds like this. Oops, a little bit of processing there. Let's just turn that off. Thank you very much. Okay. Which sounds pretty cool. So if we add that to the drum kit. Right. You can hear what that does. Right. But something happens when you add a big room mic track like that to the drums. You get, if you're 12 feet away, you get how many milliseconds of delay on the room mic?
Well,
about a foot per millisecond.
Roughly, yeah. Well, in a room like this, if we're front to back, we're what, 35 feet or something like that? So now you've got 35 milliseconds of delay. What ends up happening is your snare drum, instead of sounding like that, sounds like this. You get that flamming thing. So we love the sound of the big room, but we don't love that necessarily because it kind of makes the drum track sound indistinct. So if we go back here to our room mic track and zoom in far enough, you can see the amount of delay, right, on this bottom track. there's that much delay between the original sound and the room mic track. But we like the sound of the room mic, so what I'm going to do is move the room mic track up so that it syncs. Now, there's two ways to do it. That was the quick and dirty way that I just showed you there. But if you want to know exactly how far that is, set your nudge setting to 1 millisecond, and now just count. Set your nudge setting to minutes and seconds, and 1 millisecond, and now just go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 maybe feet away. That's maybe how far we added away. And so now when I play the track, now I have the big room sound, but it's all lined up. So now instead of having flammed hits on the snare, I get a nice solid snare hit. Those transients are no longer smeared. Yes?
Can you undo that and play the original?
Undo, maybe. Well, you know. Boom. You hear that on the snare? It's not giant because it's only 14 milliseconds. It makes it sound like it's in a big room, but it also makes those hits sound indistinct. For me, it's a little messy. I want to hear something a little tighter than that. I want to hear the size of the room. I don't necessarily want to hear those early reflections. Sure. Yeah. I mean, okay. So let's go 10, 20. That was 20, 30, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So this is approximately what a room mic would sound like in this room. You hear that? So if I solo the snare, that's the difference between the... Sorry? A little bit. Yeah, at 35 milliseconds, you're kind of in Haas effect territory, but you know, suffice it to say that it makes for, in my opinion, a less impactful drum sound. When you're doing rock music or pop or even country now, it's all about the drums. If you get the drums to sound right, the rest of the track is going to be easy to put together. So, you know, for me, it's, you know, how tight can I make the drums sound? How big can I make them sound? And so, yeah, if I go, that should cure that problem. And if I want to double check it, I'll grab my room mic track. I'll drag it right up next to the snare and zoom in and see how close I got. A little closer, a little too far. Have the big room. Now, we talked earlier about processing with the 11 BF76, the 1176 plug-in emulator. In its simplest form, it's a pretty cool compressor. You know, it if you don't abuse it, it'll. You can control the dynamic range with it. So this is just the room mic with the BF76 on it. Right? Here's bypass. Here it is in. All we're really doing is taking like 4 dB off the snare for those transients, right? So that's fairly transparent. It doesn't really have much of a personality. But there's a setting here, if you go to all buttons in, any of you who have hardware 1176s know this trick. All right, I haven't changed the gain settings at all. But now all of a sudden you're just crushing the dickens out of the drums. Now, I don't know too many instances where you would use a track alone like this, but if you take now and add this to the other tracks, so let me turn that guy down and I'll bring it up. So here's just the close mic drums. I'm gonna start to bring in this room mic now. I don't know, that's pretty cool, right? One plug-in, you know, John Bonham on one plug-in, I think that's pretty good. John Bonham in a box. Ooh, that's bad. That's, yeah, bad taste, okay. Yeah, sort of, in a box. So, I mean, and the rest of the drum kit was recorded pretty well. I mean, what do we really have as engineers to work with, right? I mean, you start out with microphone selection and placement. Those are your two basic tools. If you get those things right, then if you have a really good drummer on a really good drum kit in a really good sounding room, you know, it's pretty hard to go wrong. We had all of those things in place, except the drummer had old heads on his kit. And I, you know, kind of hated that. But you can compensate for that a certain amount with EQ. So, you know, we haven't really tarted any of the rest of this stuff up, but, we started adding plugins in class, and, you know, we had some EQ on the snare and some compression on this, and pretty soon the drums started to sound not quite right, and we were going, oh, what's wrong here? And then, you know, finally I looked up and I went, we didn't have delay compensation turned on. So all of a sudden, now you get these, you know, 400 samples here and 1,000 samples there and 4,000 samples over here. And pretty soon the drum kit's not playing in time with itself. So in a situation like this, it really makes sense to make sure you have your delay compensation turned on when you're mixing. You can't do that, though, while you're recording, because now all of a sudden every plugin that you add to the system is going to change the synchronization. It's going to change the time relationship of the pre-recorded track to whoever's overdubbing on top of it. So all these plugins have to go away when you're recording stuff.
So is that kind of an ear thing as far as knowing when to turn that on when you're mixing?
If I'm mixing, I turn it on right away.
It's just a rule.
There are two ways to set up your Pro Tools system, one for tracking, one for mixing. And I've got the specifics in here. It has to do with buffer settings. It has to do with, if you go over here to the, to the playback engine, hardware buffer size. You want to have a larger buffer when you're mixing because then you can accommodate a larger number of plugins, and you won't have buffer underrun, or you won't be, you know, if you can't get data off of your hard drives fast enough. A higher buffer setting will allow you to cache more of that audio. Conversely, if you're tracking, you want a lower buffer setting so that you can have less latency.
So you can overdub through, monitor through the DAW, and the vocalist is hearing the return of that.
Yeah.
But transparently, no problem.
Exactly. Even on a native system, you know, for that matter, as long as you keep the plugins out of the way and keep a lower buffer setting, then that works pretty well. The other thing that's a little confusing to some people is how to set the host processors and the CPU processing limit. with multi-processor systems, you would think, I'm going to max this thing out. I'm going to use up all of my processors. The fact of the matter is, with this current iteration of the Pro Tools software, they haven't really perfected the allocation of duties among multiple processors. So typically what we suggest, I've got 8 processors on this machine, they usually suggest you go about halfway or a little better. It will actually, if I set this on maximum, if I set this on 8 processors, it would actually slow down the processing speed because then Pro Tools has to stop and think, how do I allocate the duties? How do I break up these tasks for the processors to do their job? So Avid suggests that you set it about midway, and that way you don't tax the system. For CPU usage limit, the only thing you need to reserve a little bit of space for the screen redraw, but you can use, they suggest, 90 or 95% before you start to see any kind of compromise in system performance. So I set mine at 90%. rarely have any kind of problems there. Delay compensation. And again, it says here, host engine. There's a dialog box here to ignore errors during playback and record. It may cause clicks and pops. You don't want to typically do that because this is all about high quality audio, and it really doesn't matter if the system redraw slows down as long as you're hearing things correctly. Delay compensation engine is the next setting. I put it on none when tracking and maximum when mixing. Disk playback cache size. This depends on how much RAM you have in your system. I usually try to keep that fairly low if I need to decrease latency, fairly high if I'm mixing. And streaming buffer. Default setting is 250 milliseconds. I set it a little higher. I have mine set on 500 milliseconds. From the factory folks, they usually say 250 or 500 is sufficient. Now, when tracking, how many of you guys use playlists? Yeah? When would you not use a playlist?
What is a playlist?
What is a playlist? Good question. Okay. If I have, let's use this drum session. The drummer came in with this music minus one track of a Led Zeppelin tune. So we imported that file into the system, put it on a track, and that's the top track that you see highlighted here. We recorded two or three different passes. But if I wanted to record multiple passes, I have a choice. I can either copy this music track four times or however many times I need it, and then advance from one to the next, and then I have all of my takes visible on the top screen, right? Which is great if you're recording a whole band from scratch. But at some point, you'll get to a point where the drummer nailed his part and you don't need to keep recording the drummer. Now you can start fixing other parts or adding other parts. Or the guitar player and the bass player nailed their parts. Now you just need to redo the drums. Where you would use playlists is in that situation where you have some keeper tracks and you want to augment those. So if we go back to our original setup here where we have the music track, let's say that's our keeper track that we're going to use to synchronize the rest of the overdubs. Drummer records one take. I'll recreate the session here for you. If I go back to the first take of the drums, you'll see we didn't finish the song. This was the first take. So then we got our mix right in the headphones. We decided to do another take. That became take number two. He did a whole take. We did one more take just to see how crazy he could get, and that was take number three. What a playlist does is it allows you to keep certain tracks intact and layer other tracks in sync with, in this case, the stereo music mix. But the cool part about Pro Tools and what I love about this new software is the fact that I can display all of my playlists at one time. So this green track right here, I have these grouped, so now you can see all of these are highlighted. This represents the current track, which was the third playlist. But I can see all the playlists. Why would I want to do this? Well, if I'm comping a track, let's say I want to put together the best possible drum take out of all three passes that he made, I can go through here and audition each and every track in sync with that stereo music track that he played against, right? So, okay, case in point. Let's start at the beginning here. This is the track that I think is our keeper, right? So I'm going to play a little bit of that. That's really groovy. Let me move up here. He did a fill coming out of this section. Okay, that's how we ended the first half of the song. Let's say maybe I wanted to look for options. If I want to audition the very first playlist, all I have to do is open the playlist and solo the next playlist, right? And now I hear that playlist soloed against the other track that I've already recorded. So now I can hear. Yeah, not so much. So let's listen to that second playlist and see if we like that better. Oh, yeah. That's the one. Okay. So I have my main playlist up here on the top, right? But I want to add that fill from the second playlist. If I highlight that region and go over here to the little arrow and click the arrow, it promotes that piece of the playlist up to the top level. So now if I play across that edit, what it shows you is that I'm not as good an editor as I thought I was. Okay, it was a little sloppy, but you get the general idea. Where this really shines is in, obviously, in comping together drum tracks, right? Because you can take a lick at a time or a bar at a time. But in comping vocal tracks, I mean, that is one of the most time-consuming jobs. If you get it down to a science where you have a great singer and they just come in and they sing the whole song down four times, that's really easy because then you just have to listen to four takes and you pick the one you want, and you can instantly comp as you go by promoting those up to the top track, right? But if you've got 20 channels or 20 tracks of vocal takes and you've got to audition every single one, you can, on your top level, select a region that you want to play back and put it on loop play, and then go through and audition each playlist in sequence as it's rolling. So, okay, next one. Okay, next one. So I can just leave it in loop play and let it roll, and I can hear every single take in sequence, so I can decide which one I want to promote. Yeah.
Can you promote while you're in loop?
Let's make a bigger loop. It will take that region. But yeah, that's fine. So let's say I want to use... Where is it? I just erased my region. Yeah, so if I go over here and... Yes, you can do it on the fly while it's rolling. Unfortunately, if you have one of the other playlists soloed, you will continue to hear just that playlist. But yeah, so it's whatever you have soloed. Right. So, I've used this on guitar parts and on vocal parts and what have you. It's just the slickest way to go. Occasionally, you'll get a player that wants to just set it in loop mode and record 10 takes in a row back to back. Guitar players a lot of times will do this. So there's a preference that you can set that allows you to put it in loop record, and for every new pass on each loop, it will create automatically a new playlist. So all you have to do is define your region, hit play, and sit back and watch. And when those 10 passes are done, you've got 10 playlists, and it's so easy to go back and just audition the best one. I mean, it makes your life so much easier. Yeah?
Do older versions of Pro Tools have this feature?
I think it started in 9. So, it's not strictly a Pro Tools 10 function, but not everybody uses it like that.
Where
the click is?
To make that happen, how do you do that?
Oh, yeah, I have to find it because I don't know where I opened the page. But is it under editing? I'm looking.
Buy the book. What?
I wrote the book, yeah. Why are you asking me? Buy the book and tell me where it is.
Well, it's in there.
It's in there. I actually found a bunch of stuff in Pro Tools that I couldn't find a use for. There's a bunch of wacky functions in there that you, yeah. Did you find it already?
The bottom of the list.
It's right there.
Duh.
Yeah,
right above all my. Oh yeah, right. Okay. So under the operation page, automatically create new playlists when loop recording.
Thank you.
Well, let's just test that through. Oh, I don't have any inputs. Never mind. So if I just set that region and hit record, it would loop and loop and loop and loop and loop, and every time it made a loop, it would add a new playlist. Which is really nifty. And your clients will think you're a wizard because, you know, you did all that stuff while, you know, reading the newspaper or something.
Is your interface much different in Windows? I mean, I use Windows version.
No.
It's the same except for the key commands, the key command modifiers, right? So, you know, command C on a Mac is, what's the equivalent, Alt C, Control C?
Control C, copy.
Okay.
Copy?
Control C. Control C, okay. So that's the only difference is the modifier key. Yeah. Oh. Well, yeah. See, that's the whole thing. When you're tracking a full band, it's you know, I like to see all my takes in a row so that I can look at them and go, oh, okay, this is the one I like better. I'll make a mark on this one, and I can go back and audition without having to make any changes. I can instantly go from take three to take seven. But when it comes time to work on a track and add alternate parts, once I know the keeper take, playlists are absolutely the way to go. Yes. Well, in this particular case, technically the drummer was overdubbing on the stereo.
Yeah, but the guitar part, the voice part that you're doing this on overdub, mm-hmm. you just let him do it, and listen to the track.
Yeah. Huge time saver. What else is fun? How many of you guys use master faders? Does anybody not use a master fader? Yeah? Why? Yeah, you know, I've heard a lot of things to that effect, and I've read a lot of things that talk about, you know, the capability of the mix bus and summing bus and you know, adding a master does this or does that. But the reality is, if you have one on screen, if you've created a master fader in your session or not, it's still there. You can't get rid of it. It's there.
There's a master bus.
Yeah, there's a summing bus that mixes all of your tracks together, and whether or not you've created a master fader to access it, it's still there. So you might as well have it in there. The other thing is, if you don't have it there, metering becomes kind of an iffy question. I mean, you can meter an aux bus if you're mixing everything through an aux, but you still have that master there, so you really don't know what your output looks like. And let's talk about mixing in the box for a minute. This is a huge bugaboo with people who are making a transition from analog to digital. Or even people who grew up dig and really don't understand summing buses. I grew up on an analog console, and if I got to the mix and everything, let me turn on all these faders. If my mix looked like that on an analog console, I knew what my master fader and my master meter was going to look like. It was going to look all red, and my headroom would be gone, and I'd probably be clipping the output. But for some reason, in Pro Tools and in workstations, people don't seem to have that same innate ability to look at that and go, that's going to be too darn loud. I mean, if I've done a good job of recording my tracks and they're all average of minus 6 dB FS, or peak of minus 6 dB FS and average of minus 12 or something like that, that's a huge amount of gain to push through a mix bus. So the first thing you have to think about when mixing in the box is manage your gain. Instead of going louder with everything, turn it down. Start everything, you know, at minus 6 or minus 10.
I've got some instructors down in L.A. that teach you to ram everything up and then adjust it through limiters and compressors at the tail end.
Ay, Chihuahua, really?
Yeah, he was Brian somebody who was doing sound masters or something that had a studio teaching people that in the 80s. And that was his method, just shove it all the way up. And I've seen so many people do
that was
rock
the 80s,
and roll.
Though.
Well, I've seen people even today in rock and roll, some of these outside bands and mixed guys, mixed consoles, they'll have it slammed all the way up into the red. And they'll have it over, and they won't be adjusting the volume through the pots. They'll be adjusting only through the compressor and limiters.
You know, arguably in an analog console, you can kind of get away with that because even at the top of the meter, a really well-built console is going to have 24 dB of headroom over and above whatever you see on the meter. And so it's pretty hard to clip out an individual channel. But even on an analog console, if you have all of your faders, you know, if everything is recorded well, if you have all of your faders up, that's all going to hit the mix bus and it's going to be calamitous. It's going to be distortion a go-go. It looks good. It does look pretty. I have to confess. It looks pretty, but it sounds like donkey.
Well, Well, if your ears are blown out because you've been doing too much rock and roll and other things in them, you know, for a long time, then I guess.
I'm sorry? What? No. Huh? So Pro Tools, the Pro Tools engineers put out a white paper, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, that talked about the mathematics that goes into creating a digital mix bus. And they went through a very technical explanation of how, you know, with a 32-bit floating point mixer and then a 48-point mixer and now a 48-bit and now a 64-bit floating point mixer, how you have 1,500 dB of headroom, theoretically, after you sum all of the channels. I mean, the mathematics are just amazing in this thing. Right. Yeah, right. So the reality is, though, if you take all of these faders and you go like that, you're going to end up with distortion on the output. So what I try to ask people to do is think about this as though you can't control those things with limiters and compressors. Think about how you want your output meter to look. So when I mix, when I'm tracking, I have a master fader and I keep my eye on the master meter just to make sure I'm not clipping a headphone mix or something like that. But when it comes time for me to mix, I do a couple of things. Yes, I usually put dynamics on my output fader, but that's just because I like the way it sounds. But I put meters in. So let's see what I have here under sound field. Not very much. I should have brought my waves. Yeah, it probably does. I usually use the Dereau meters in the Waves bundle. I have Waves Mercury bundle, and they've got these amazing Dereau meters that are incredibly accurate. You can blow them up to be full screen width if you want. But I keep an eye on the meters at the beginning of my signal chain and at the end of the signal chain. The reason I do that is on the channels, the meters will tell you what's playing back. The meters will not show you what your processing is doing to the sound. They will show you the playback, they will not show you the result of your processing. On the output, they will show you the result of your processing, but they won't show you what's coming in. So if you have a big old limiter clamped on your stereo mix bus, it'll show you the result of what's coming through the limiter, but it won't show you what you're slamming into the mix bus before it gets to the limiter. So I put in 2 meters. I put in one at the very top of the chain to show me what's coming into my mix bus, and I put one at the very end to show me what's coming out. And typically, I mix with 2 meter or monitors, so it's easy for me to have, you know, all my plugins on the second monitor so I can see what's going on. But that way, you can control your gain structure. It's all about gain structure in a mix bus. If you overload the front end of your mix bus, it doesn't matter what kind of limiting or compression or gain control you use, it's distorted.
Do you have options where you can stick your meter? I mean, post-EQ, post-fader?
It's modular. So if you look up here, I can put in... I can't believe I don't have any meters here. But this will work. So let's see. Okay, so if you ignore the scope part of this thing, if you ignore the scope and just look at the meters here, right, that's showing peaks of minus 6 dBFS. So that's acceptable. So then let's say I put in a Maxim plugin, which is an atom smasher. It's a limiter, which could be used as a brick wall limiter. Does this one have a mix control?
Yeah, it's in the bottom. Where
they moved it. Oh, yeah, okay. They changed it. New look for Maxim. And then if that's the only processing I'm doing, then I'll put in another meter at the end. And so I'll have this one over here, and I don't need to see all of it. I just need to see that much. And I'll have this one over here. And I don't need to see all of it. I just need to see that much. So now, if I turn on Maxim and I crush the willies out of this. Sorry. Got it. Right. So now you can see that on the left side, on this meter right here, the leftmost meter, that's what's going in to the mix bus. And the one on the right is what's coming out of the mix bus. So yes, I have a kind of a jacked signal path here, but you can see the difference, and that's really important. You want to know what's happening, and if you're going to overload something, do it as a personal choice. Do it as an artistic choice. Do it because you know the rules, but you choose to break them. Don't do it just because that's how it ended up. Make it a choice. Yes.
If you're not going to put a limiter on your mix bus, would you consider the meters, adequate, the ones that are on the mix bus?
They're kind of small, and the resolution is not all that great. I like to know a little bit more of it. That's why I like the Duro meters, because it shows you where the sweet spot is. And yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I prefer to know a little bit more about it. This phase meter has a reasonable resolution, so you can kind of see what's going on. Steve?
Just like gain structure within your system, you need to think about where the file is going to go next as well. Is it going to go to mastering? Are you making a pre-master, or are you going out to give it to the drummer to go play in his truck?
Right.
You got two different ways of looking at that. And for an appropriate pre-master, you want to have the levels low and a high bit rate, bit depth. So you have a lot of headroom, so the mastering engineer can turn it up as well as turn it down.
Exactly.
If we get it at, already crammed, we're going to turn it down anyway. So give it to us soft. Don't give us half-baked files. Because we're going to bake it all the way. We don't want to put it back to raw and then bake it.
Which is a perfect transition for getting out of your mix. Once you've controlled your gain to the point where you know what's going into your mix, your summing bus, you know what's coming out of it, you have to decide exactly what Steve said. Is this something that's going to mastering? Is this something that's not going to mastering? Is this a reference mix, or is this something that's going to be pressed or live as a final version for sale somewhere? If it's going to a mastering engineer, one of two things should happen. One most certainly is you should, if you're going to manage the dynamic range by putting a compressor or a limiter on the mix bus, leave some room for the mastering engineer to do their work. What a lot of folks are suggesting, and everyone, that's part two, what everyone is suggesting most recently is peaks of -6 and average of -12 dB or something like that. That's what Bob Ludwig suggests. Right. Yeah, exactly. So, and try not to overcompress or overlimit it, because you can't replace those transients, those dynamics, once they're gone. The second part of that is talk to your mastering engineer. If you know it's going to a mastering engineer, call him up, write him an email, find out what their specs are. Steve will tell you exactly what he wants from you.
The box and out of the box are completely different, too, as far as what you give to them. Because out of the box, mm-hmm. In the box, you're going to end up at 44.1 anyway. So there's
ultimately,
no reason to,
you out of here. Thanks, Brian.
To augment that.
So right.
I like 44.1, 24 bit. Whereas out of the box, there is a reason to do 96K and the like, because it's going to be taken and translated into a different world. Right? I'm sending all your
school night. Thanks for coming. So the idea is, have a conversation with your mastering engineer. They will tell you exactly what they want to see from you. And as a mix engineer, it's good to have that relationship anyway, because you want to be able to call them up and go, how did it go? What did you end up having to do to this in order to finish it? I've been very fortunate in that mix engineer or mastering engineers have been painfully truthful with me on how my mixes sound, and it's made me a better mixer as a result. But it's good to have that relationship, because Steve and other mastering engineers represent an objective opinion about what you do and about the marketplace and how things should sound. From time to time, you will be called upon to self-master or create a finished final copy of whatever it is that you're working on. If you have a band that you're working with a group that wants to put a song up on their website immediately, or they want to release an iTunes, a YouTube video or something like that, you have to think about things a little differently. I still hold to that minus 6 dB peak, minus 12 dB average, if possible. But the fact of the matter is you're competing with some of the other content that's out there, and you're working with people who will master like the Metallica Black record. You know, where, yeah, you put it up on the waveform display, and it looks like a stick of butter. You know, it's just no breaks in it. You know, you can't really compete with that. Not to go down this rabbit hole too far, but I will mention that there is a new Mastered for iTunes initiative that helps engineers figure out what the optimum levels are to prepare a song for release on iTunes. Now, iTunes has a level matching function in it, so theoretically, it shouldn't matter if your peaks are zero, you know, 100% modulation, or if your peaks are minus 12. Theoretically, iTunes should compensate for that difference in level across the rest of your library, so that if you go from Metallica to Eric Satie, there shouldn't be an apparent disparate amplitude change.
That's the theory. Eric Satie that loud?
Well, I think the idea is that they turn Metallica now. But what do I know? But if you are going to master your own stuff, I would say, first of all, try to avoid using a multiband compressor. It's so easy to take a left turn and end up in the ditch with those things unless you're really, really experienced with it and or you know exactly what you want it to sound like. I like a plugin like Maxim because even though it can be a heavy sledgehammer, it can also be your friend in a lot of ways because it has this one little control on the bottom that that allows you to bring back some of the transients into your compressed signal. So let me try to undo some of the ugliness that I did here. I'm going to play again. Look out. Okay. So if I set my ceiling for minus 6... ish, give or take. I'm going to set my threshold so that my gain reduction is no more than, you know, minus 2 dB. I guess I should play the whole song, shouldn't I? This is kind of... Okay. All right. So my gain reduction is going to be no more than minus 2, right? So I'll set my threshold accordingly. Now, right now, I've got a pretty fast release time. For mastering, I would probably open that up. I mean, you know, your mileage may vary anywhere from half a second to a second or something like that. You'll know it when you hear it. But if I crush it harder, let's say I'm going to go for 6 dB of gain reduction. Right, that's pretty hard limiting, you know, the transient peaks aren't really coming out where they were before, and there's not really a lot of life in it because I've taken all those transients and I've squashed them down. There's a mix control down here at the very bottom that allows me to control how much compressed signal passes through versus how much uncompressed signal. It's kind of cool that they do this all in one package. We used to have to do this as a parallel process. Sometimes it's called New York style compression, where you're adding compressed sound to the uncompressed sound and you're balancing between the two so that you have all of the dynamic range control of a compressed signal, but you're still retaining the transient peaks of the uncompressed signal. This allows you to do it all in one package. So I can compress, you know, I can 6 dB of gain reduction, but still retain the peaks. So here's the big compression. Now if I back it off to like 75% mix, right? So I'm using 75% compressed sound to 25% uncompressed sound. I still have that dynamic range control, but now some of those transients, some of that life is coming back in the track. So when you're mastering your own stuff, think about that. Try not to crush all the life out of it. And it'll sound better on the internet. It'll sound better whatever you're playing it back on.
Just a point is, yeah. Mastering is not just one plug-in at the end of the chain.
This is not a mastering class. If you remember my caveat at the beginning of this discussion, it was if you are forced into the position of having to master something for immediate release, this is a simple way to get it right. I like to adopt the standards of Hippocrates, who said, first do no harm. And so in audio land, what that means is leave some life in the patient.
That's a good t-shirt.
Yeah.
And the, you know, the band may come back to you and say, it doesn't sound like Metallica. And you say, thank your lucky stars that it doesn't sound like Metallica. I mean, that's a... I don't know how you feel about that, Steve. You probably have an opinion. But.
Depends on what the client wants for you.
Yeah. Well, ultimately, they're paying the bill. So if they want you to remove all the life from the client, absolutely. Yes.
Can I run off subject just for one question?
Certainly. Wait, Rick, time check. When do we...
We should probably wind it up about 10:30.
Okay. Yeah. Please do.
Just voices. I'm not sure that I understand. Are voices like a mathematical calculation, never to be changed by buffer settings, or I mean, how do you calculate how many voices if you're given an X amount of voices to do your mix? How do you manage that? I mean, how do you manage it?
It's the number of outputs you require to do the job, and that varies. Now, if I have 10 tracks, well, in this case, I have, 14 tracks of drums. If I have 14 tracks of drums and I'm playing them back without any plugins, theoretically, it should take 14 voices. But I have two additional voices because I have a master. And if I use a drum submix, then I have a stereo drum submix, then I have two additional voices that are required for that because it's another aux bus. If I add a plugin, an RTOS plugin, that's another voice, because it has to route out of your signal path to another device, processor, and then back in. So that's another voice.
Just one, not two. Not one in, one out.
Right. But if you're running a TDM system, and you decide to use an RTOS plugin, and then a TDM plugin, and then an RTOS plugin, you have one voice, two voices, three voices, four voices, five voices in order to accomplish that signal path. So now you have to start thinking about how you assemble your signal path. You try to use all TDM plugs if you can. Try to use all RTOS plugins if you can. If you mix them, you double the amount of voices that you use. Because it's like a patch bay. You know, think of a voice as a patch cord. Right? So it's not a secret mathematical formula. It's really physics. You know, if you want the sound to go from here to here, you have to use a patch cable. That's a voice. If you want it to come back, it's another voice. If you want to go to an HD TDM plugin, it's another patch cable. So think about it that way. So you can have a 20-channel mix that runs you out of voices.
Right. And if you're running 96K, you have less voices?
Apparently? Yes, you have fewer patch cables. Wow, how's that for an oversimplification? Yeah, basically. The higher the capacity or the higher the resolution, the fewer voices you have available to you. Right. Anybody here record higher than 96K sample rate? Come on, fess up. You all tried it.
I tried.
Nobody on a regular basis? Yeah. There's the double E's in the room would probably speak to this much better than I, but there's a common theory out there that right now the I/O, the A to D's and D to A's, are not of sufficient quality at this point to really warrant recording at 192 or 176, blah, blah, blah.
The nice thing about that, though, is because they have the quality to be able to do that, they have a lot better control at the lower rates.
Right.
If you have like a 16-bit thing or a 44.1 that maxes out there, then that's at the edge of their capabilities. But right. If they have a high-density piece, then you're well within their error situations. They got all that. They're relaxing instead of having to fight to be as good as they can.
Right. Yeah, you're not maxing out your system every time you try to record. I belong to a group within the Recording Academy called the Producers and Engineers Wing. And every once in a while we'll get together and talk about the quality of audio and how things are going with regard to technology. And I remember one discussion that was actually kind of funny. We said, what's the optimum? You know, we're supposed to be out here hanging our shingle out there saying, we're going to tell the rest of the industry what's best, what sounds the best. Do we want to be 24-bit 192? Do we want to be 2496? And everybody's, oh, 2496, absolutely, 2496. I said, okay, are we willing to put out a statement to the rest of the industry saying 24-bit 96K sample rate is the standard that we hold forward as being the best? And then all of a sudden people started going, no, wait a minute. Now just hold your horses for a minute. And what we found out is that hip-hop producers, I hate to make general statements, but I'm going to make one in this case. A lot of hip-hop producers like the sound of 16-bit 44.1. And I kind of scratch my head about that, and I go, well, you know, you have to max all of your signal out in order to be able to get a 16-bit recording, and then you don't have any margin of error, and then you have to limit. Yeah, exactly. That's how you use that tool. And if you go, again, you know, with the generalities, hip-hop records are pretty loud. You know, when you've got a big bass line and lots of 808 kick drum or whatever the low end has in it, they're using up a lot of that dynamic range. They're using up an awful lot of the high end of that dynamic range. And so do you really need 24 bits 96? You know, some would say no. And if you ask Jimmy Douglas, who produces a lot of records in a lot of different styles, he will tailor the response of his system for the style of music that he's working on. And when he does hip hop, he prefers to use 16-44-1. So it's pretty hard to argue with that. And it's pretty hard to go into a community of producers and say, you need to be using 2496. We're going to advise all the manufacturers to only make, you know, this kind of capability because it doesn't work that way. So even though we may have the capability of running 24-bit 192K sessions, you know, consider the source. Consider what you're working on. Consider what sounds best for the gig. And whatever the style of music is or whatever the performance. We are just about running out of time. Yes?
Sorry, I was just
going to... Yeah, I was going to say, ask me questions.
Wouldn't it be generally advisable to use a sample rate that's mathematically compatible with the ultimate sample rate that you'll be ending up with in the finished product?
If you knew that you were producing music that was going to be released on CD, for example, yeah, you would want to be compatible with 44.1 as a sample rate. So if I know that something's going to CD, I'll record it some multiple of 44.1. But where it kind of gets into a sticky wicket is, what if they're releasing a video as well, or a DVD, or if it's going to be on broadcast television? Then what do you do? You know, that's all 48K or you know, some derivative of 48K math. While the converters are getting better and better, the software converters to go from 44.1 to 48 or vice versa, Some mastering engineers prefer to go analog if they have to go from 44.1 to 48 or from 96 to 44.1 or whatever that transcode is. They feel that an analog step retains more of the original character of the sound rather than doing a mathematical conversion. Just really high quality A to D, D to A. You know, I haven't heard of anyone using tape because you'd be adding some noise to the...
And some people like to do that. There are people that, when they do mastering out of the box, sometimes they go right out into the tape machine and right back in off the tape.
Off the repro head.
Systems.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a sound. You know, it's like any other processor at that point. You know, tape machine has plug-in, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, big, expensive, high-maintenance plug-in. But, yeah. Questions? Rick is going to shut me down in a few minutes here.
Question about clip gain.
Yes.
I exchange a lot of sessions between myself, I'm running 10, and other folks who are running less than that.
Yep.
Is there a way to batch render clips?
Yep. I got to find it now.
For the clip gain?
Yeah.
Yes.
Where is it? Okay. Under the clip menu in 10, you can't do this in 9 because it doesn't go that way. Under clip gain, if you go down here to the clip gain menu, you can bypass the clip gain. You can render the clip gain. What that does is it when you render the clip gain, it rewrites that file and embeds that using the parameters of the clip gain that you've set to rewrite that file. So essentially it's normalizing each file. So it's rewriting each file on the hard drive. So that's one way to do it. Another way to do it is...
Is that for just the clips that are selected at that time?
No, I think it's global.
So did you do a save as and create a new session name or whatever?
That would be advisable. Do a save as or save copy as, and then in that session make your renders. There's I'd have to find it in here, but there's also a way to either convert clip gain information to automation data, or vice versa. Oh God, I've got to find it now.
Could you just bounce it and make a new track?
By rendering?
Yeah.
Yeah, you could. I mean, there's a way to do it automatically in here. There's a render clip gain settings. So, you know, you could do that. I think, I'm not sure if it's selective or if it's global. I've not tried it on an entire session before. But there are several ways to do it. I think for you, I don't like rendering files once I've recorded them. I mean, that makes me nervous. So I think the best way to handle that is if you've done a lot of clip gain stuff, change that to automation data. Now, keep in mind, when your friend gets that on his Pro Tools 9 system, it's not going to hit his signal chain the same way it hits yours, because you've normalized everything.
You can only go up 12 dB.
Right.
And so with a lot of time clip gain, I'm way over that.
Yeah. Well, and it's like I said, it's not going to hit your compressor the same way either, because automation is after the signal processing,
right. And
clip gain is before the signal processing, if that makes sense. So, but that's one way to translate it. So you would have to weigh, you know, what the track is and what you want to accomplish. In that case, you know, if you were concerned about the way it hits your signal chain, render it. Is there a question on this side? No?
I have a few got time.
Yeah, go.
In the playback engine portion that we went over earlier,
yeah.
The hardware buffer.
Yes. How many inputs did you have?
Eight.
And what were you recording to? What kind of hard drive?
It's a MacBook Pro. It wasn't my computer, so I'm not really familiar.
You were recording to the internal drive?
Yes.
That's part of the problem.
And that goes back to the FireWire situation you're talking about at the beginning.
Yeah.
Literally operating the session off of the FireWire.
Yeah. Yeah. Even though you can record to the internal drive, it's not a good idea to do that.
Aren't most internal drives 5400 also?
Yeah.
So the drive speed is rotations.
So 8 channels, you know, going into your internal drive, it literally may not be fast enough to record or play that back. So, I would cut down on the buffer at that point. But most get an external drive.
I got the same one, so I'll just pop in the next.
Perfect.
I was just going to ask a question.
Yeah.
On this subject. Say you don't have the external drive. Can you? Is there any advantage to partitioning the OneDrive you have?
No. You're making it work twice as hard.
Slow. It's still
going to be slow.
I think this has come up before, but nobody had ever told me.
Yeah. 5,400 RPM is a pretty slow seek time. And so partitioning is just, you're asking it to... look across the two partitions of a drive with two different tree directories at a fairly slow scan speed. So it's really not going to help, I don't think.
Yeah. PPA drive, and they didn't want to sell me anything that had over a 80 gig partition, I think.
And but he's talking about the internal drive.
Yeah,
talking about partitioning the internal drive.
I was just wondering if there's any issue with Pro Tools writing to...
To partition size? There used to be.
Yeah,
not anymore. With Pro Tools 9, I think they got away from maximum partition sizes. And, you know, that keeps getting better and better, to the point now where I'll record to a 4-terabyte drive and not partition it at all. It used to take forever to find and play back the files if they were greater than, you know, 2 gigabytes in size or something like that, but that's not a problem anymore.
I'd like to make an announcement before we break. Is that there's an event coming up on March 16th. here that's sponsored by the Mostly Modular Trade Association, Recording Academy, and the Audio Engineering Society, which is a synth fest. And we have a synth modular synth petting zoo that's going to be in one room.
Wow.
We have a jam room that'll have sort of a shared house clock.
So these are not VIs. These are like analog synths.
This is modular synth.
Real synthesizers.
Show you the patch cords.
Real patch cords.
Yeah. Real patch cords.
Yeah.
This is going to be a telepresence and performance space where we're going to have, like, Gordon Raphael is going to shoot in from Berlin to show the difference between an Arp Odyssey and a Moog, and then there's going to be like a trade show room with a lot of other things. So that's an all-day event on March 16th, and everybody wins, everybody's invited.
Free?
Yes, free.
No charge,
yeah.
Analog Maximus.
That's right.
Glenn, how about a solid-state drive?
We talked about that a little bit before. Really fast access times. I'm not so sure about the long-term stability of data on a solid-state drive, but certainly it's perfectly good as a working drive.
Well, nobody really knows the long-term storage on a regular old drive. They haven't had them very long. Yeah. Not like they've been around 50 years.
Oh, on a regular drive? Well, I mean,
yeah.
The manufacturers say 3 years.
Yeah, 3 years.
And that's only if you exercise them every 3 months or something like that. And I've had drives go bad after 2 weeks, so there's no guarantee, even on the highest quality drive, that they're going to last beyond 3 years.
But a solid-state drive is quicker.
Absolutely.
With the I.O., right?
Yeah. Yep.
So better performance.
Yes.
Hopefully.
Yeah, I've not done a big session on one.
And the pricing, right? But,
yeah. Any other questions, folks? Thank you so much for coming out. I really appreciate you taking time, and I hope this has been... Thanks to Rick and Steve and for Rich and all of you folks. This was...
thanks for staying late.
I don't know what the next meeting is. Don't have a date. Don't have a topic. It'll be audio.
There'll be audio there.